From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now, and we're learning more about the man that police killed in Nice, France last night after he plowed through a crowded Bastille Day celebration. Mohamed Bolel was a Tunisian man who lived in Nice. The French prosecutor said this about the attacker this morning.
Mohamed Bolel was a delivery driver. He was married and head of a family. His wife has been detained as of 11 o'clock this morning. Mohamed Lawej Bouled was known by the judicial and police authorities for threats, violence, thefts between 2010 and 2016.
84 people were killed, including two Americans, a father and his 11-year-old son from Texas. There has been no claim of responsibility from any terrorist groups, and France is observing 3 days of mourning and has extended the national state of emergency that was due to be lifted later this month. Joining us now from Nice is the BBC's Nick Garnett. Nick, thanks for being here.
Very good afternoon to you.
And Nick, I understand you're right there on the scene where all this unfolded. What are you seeing?
Right. In front of me, there is a lorry behind some police barricades, really, that are trying to shield what we can see, but it's very obvious what's there. It's a lorry, a big lorry, 20 to 25 ton lorry, that yesterday evening at around 20:30, about 8:30 local time, just after a fireworks display in the town, came out of the side streets and careered down the main boulevard at the front, where thousands of people had gathered. The road had been closed because of the celebrations. Thousands of people were there. And this lorry careered down this area for around 1 to 1.2 miles before it was stopped by the police. The police managed to get in front of it and managed to shoot at the driver inside the vehicle, killing him. There are 26 bullet holes in the windscreen of the vehicle that we can see. It looks like it was a rented van, a rented lorry, and it's just left there, abandoned at the moment, sealed off, as is the whole of the boulevard at the front. And it's surrounded by people who've come down to see and to pay their respects to what happened here. And people have been coming down, coming past me with little bunches of flowers that they're laying down here, some of them in the French colours, in the French tricolour.
Terrible, Nick. But some details are emerging about the man who was driving that truck. What can you tell us?
Right, the man appears to be of French-Tunisian background. There are an awful lot of French-Tunisian people living in this part of France. He was known to the police, but when they've been asked, the prosecutors have said that he wasn't a terrorist suspect at all. He was known for petty crime, for minor offences involving drugs and wine. He'd been known and he'd been on the radar, but he'd not been thought to be anyone of note. And at the moment, the police investigation is looking at him, looking at why he may have started this, but also who he was friends with, who he knew. Was he acting alone? Was he acting on the behest of anybody else? Or was he just a lone lunatic? The really awful thing about this is that Paris was attacked just 8 months ago. And in that attack, using suicide bombers and guns and thousands of bullets, over 130 people died. Nearly as many people died here just by a lorry being driven into them. The lorry was so big that there was no stopping it, and it just careered through people in utter carnage. And that's what people are having real problems getting to terms with. The fact that this wasn't a suicide bombing, this wasn't an attack with guns and weapons, this was just a lorry that had been hired that did so much damage.
Well, and you mentioned this attack in Paris a few months ago. The man had driven through this crowd for more than a mile. Is there any feeling that security could have been tighter at this large public event? It was planned well in advance. All of Europe has been on alert for so many months.
Yeah, and the whole of France has. There's been a state of emergency that's been in place since then, which has banned public demonstrations, public parades. But this was Bastille Day. This was the biggest holiday. This was the 4th of July for France. This was such an important time. And they had come down here. They had come down in their thousands to celebrate that. Maybe they had taken their eye off the ball after the Euro 2016 soccer tournament that had been taking place over the last month here, because that went off without a hitch. There was no security leak at all. And really, the French have been applauded for that across the continent, because they managed to keep that one safe. Perhaps they'd let their guard down. But, you know, how can you defend yourself against something that we all do? We all drive vehicles. You know, this wasn't the police missing a terrorist who had guns and weapons and grenades. This was somebody driving a vehicle. And there is really no way that you can defend against that.
I imagine you've been speaking with people there at the scene. There must just be a feeling in France and in Nice that these attacks just won't end.
I think that there's a certain underlying anger at what's happening, and that's not being borne out in any sort of racial element, but it's an anger, really, that if the authorities know that there is the risk, and as you said, had they let their guard down, that perhaps they should be doing more. But there were thousands and thousands of police out. I have a friend who had travelled through Nice the other day and said there was high security, that that all passports were being checked, even though this area of Europe, you don't need to check your passport in every time you go from one country to another. But those guards were in place, and those extra security layers were in place. It wasn't enough, obviously, because this was somebody who was actually in the country, who was living in this city that appears to have done this.
The BBC's Nick Garnett speaking to us from the scene of the attack in Nice, France. Nick, thank you for your reporting.
Lovely. Take care.
The attack in Nice was the reason Donald Trump postponed today's news conference, at which he'd planned to announce his vice presidential running mate. But that didn't stop him from taking to Twitter. This morning, the presumptive Republican nominee sent out a tweet that Indiana's Governor Mike Pence will be joining him on the ballot. Pence has governed Indiana since 2013. He is 57 years old, known as a staunch conservative. Michael Puente is Northeast Indiana reporter for WBEZ. He joins us now. Hello, Mike.
Hey, hello, Lisa.
What else do we need to know about Mike Pence?
Well, of course, you just mentioned Mike Pence is the 50th governor of the state of Indiana. He's an attorney. He's an Indiana University graduate, married, father of three, staunch anti-abortion, Christian conservative individual. He grew up in Columbus, Indiana, which is about an hour south of Indianapolis. And I think he's a Cubs fan.
And you think he's a Cubs fan as well? Well, that
yeah,
is telling.
There you go.
So he had to drop, though, in fact, today by noontime Indiana time, he had to drop his bid to rejoin Indiana's gubernatorial race. He was going to run for reelection. Today was the deadline to withdraw. As he does that and joins the Trump campaign, what does he bring to it?
Well, Lisa, he brings three major things. Pence is someone who's always on point. He's clear, concise messages, someone who's strong in his delivery, but always respectful, which is, let's face it, directly opposite of that of Donald Trump. Second, Mike Pence brings his strong Christian conservative background. His biggest base of support in Indiana are from conservative Republicans. A prominent preacher in Indiana told me this week he views Pence as a sort of anti-Trump. And third, he's also someone who's strong on business. All the two between Mike Pence and Donald Trump, they may differ on trade agreements. He is really big on businesses in Indiana.
And in terms of his popularity, though, in Indiana, it is he's not at the top of the list, we should say.
He's not. I mean, he was facing a tough re-election challenge by John Gregg. And, you know, Mike Pence is someone who has kind of polarized some folks in his own party. And some people have said already that they're not entirely, you know, sad to see Mike Pence go from Indiana. So, no, he's not the most popular person in Indiana.
What would he bring to a Trump campaign in terms of foreign affairs? Because that's one area where Donald Trump is lacking. What's Mike Pence's experience there, since he did serve in Congress?
Well, he did serve in Congress for 12 years. He's on several foreign affairs committees. This is somebody who does still pay attention to what's happening in the world. He has traveled abroad, even on trade agreements. He went to Japan. He's gone to China. I'm not sure if that counts as a foreign level experience, but he does build those business partnerships. So that might go a long way in aiding him in his foreign affairs experience.
In terms of domestic policy within Indiana, he faced a lot of criticism for signing the Religious Freedom Restoration Bill into law. That aimed at allowing employees and companies to express their religious beliefs. And critics say, on the other hand, it allows for discrimination against the LGBT community. This kind of conservative background, how is it right now serving him in Indiana, and how could it serve Trump?
Well, that's a base Mr. Trump is struggling to attract. And Mike Pence, certainly, that's his base of support in Indiana. I think that's what that's probably the main thing why he wanted to get Mr. Pence on the ticket. He brings that kind of backing with Christian conservatives. I mean, you got to also understand, besides RFRA, Mike Pence also signed a bill that would have limited abortions to women in Indiana. And there was a federal lawsuit against that, and there was an injunction just put in place on July 1st. So this is somebody who, again, doesn't back away from being anti-abortion or having concerns against the LGBT community. But Mike Pence, that's his strong background, and that's what Trump probably wants.
Thank you. Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana reporter for WBEZ. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa.
After the Cleveland Cavaliers won the NBA championship last month, more than 1 million people lined the streets for a victory parade. But much to their frustration, they immediately noticed their ability to get online with their phones was hampered by too much demand. That clogged system is something city officials hope to avoid when the Republican National Convention gets underway on Monday. Mark Uricki from Here and Now contributor WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland reports on the IT makeover.
The city of Cleveland's IT spruce-up for the RNC began months ago here, just beneath Public Square. AT&T installed conduit for new fiber-optic cables underneath so that the main convention sites are linked together. Adam Grzybicki is the president of AT&T Ohio.
If you think about, you know, the location of that, you have casino in one direction, convention center in another, you know, Q and Progressive in another. You know, it's really an epicenter for downtown and an epicenter for our network.
But underground, workers found some pretty corroded pipes. The company's area manager for network and process, Christy Moore, worked on the Democratic convention in Charlotte 4 years ago. She says Cleveland is like most cities when it comes to phone and internet infrastructure.
It was average, but we did have to do some repair work to, you know, so we've enhanced what was already in place and made it even better.
That includes upgrading data speed at 165 cell towers and antennas in the area. As the convention's official communications provider, AT&T promised to lay 50,000 feet of optical fiber, but has already done 70,000 feet and may go beyond that. Much of that is connecting the Quicken Loans Arena and providing high-def television feeds to reporters at the Huntington Convention Center 5 blocks away. That infrastructure will be useful for future conventions, says Lev Gonick. He's the CEO of One Community, a nonprofit advocate for building broadband in Northeast Ohio.
There will be significant capacity both at the convention center and at the Global Center for Health Innovation, a legacy of the RNC, because everybody is priming the pump, as it were, to make sure that there's capacity. But we will be able to offer robust services to the next events.
AT&T officials say the tech installations for political party conventions 4 years ago were a drop in the bucket compared to what's happening this year. AT&T's Grzybicki explains the company is providing internet access to 15,000 reporters at the convention center and 35,000 delegates in the Quicken Loans Arena.
Not half the audience is going to have their cell phone out snapping pictures and taking video. It's probably going to be the entire audience.
AT&T spent some $350 million building out their Cleveland area network over the last 3 years. And Grzybicki says most of this year's investment will stay in the city.
In and around the perimeter, I'm sure there'll be a couple temporary towers that we'll put up. But that's the extent of it. You know, in terms of the outdoor antenna systems, the indoor antenna systems, the upgrades that we're making at the cell towers, those are all permanent. Obviously, the fiber is all permanent. The vast majority of what we're doing is here to stay.
Those aren't the only electronics likely to stay. The federal government is providing security money to Cleveland and Cuyahoga County, part of which will be used for security cameras. One Community's Lev Gonick says some cameras will be used to track vehicle traffic and could be used later by the Regional Transit Authority, or RTA.
There will be additional investments coming to Cleveland as part of the RNC to make sure that those thousands of buses that the RTA is deploying will actually produce optimized routes And that will be in part enabled by smart traffic technology. Those sensors and those cameras could have a life beyond the RNC.
Gonick notes another nice benefit. Cisco Systems is donating its Wi-Fi routers from the convention to the Cleveland Municipal School District. But he laments that area cities and counties did not work together to ask for more.
How many other things could the schools be able to take advantage of if we said, you know, schools first for all of the digital infrastructure that's coming to Cleveland? What else could we be doing?
Besides the official networks, other cell phone companies and local businesses and hotels are reportedly also upgrading their networks for the convention. For Here and Now, I'm Mark Uricchi in Cleveland.
Republican Donald Trump has tweeted the announcement of his vice presidential running mate today. It is Indiana Republican Governor Mike Pence. Trump's pick of Pence comes just in time for the kickoff of the Republican convention in Cleveland. Trump has also released a slate of speakers at next week's convention, and the lineup is conspicuous for its lack of high-profile politicians and celebrities and even sports figures. Also distinguished by their absence, major donors and corporations. In the past, they've contributed money, goods, and services to the GOP convention. Here and Now, media analyst John Carroll joins us to talk about the no-show sponsors. Hi, John.
Hi, Lisa.
First off, why is this happening?
Well, part of it is the trick-or-treat nature of Donald Trump's candidacy. He's such an unknown that a number of corporations don't want to take a chance that something would go sideways at this convention. But part of it is also the possibility of protests and some kind of backlash from that. And there have been a number of activist groups who've put pressure on potential sponsors not to contribute to the convention.
Which sounds like it's working then.
An activist group called Color of Change says that 15 companies have declined to sponsor because of the pressure they put on them. They especially went after Coca-Cola, which is normally a big sponsor. They had given money last year to the host committees, but they say they're not doing anything more this year.
And, a lot of money, $75,000.
$75,000. But, I mean, normally they would give in the high six figures. So so this is symptomatic of what's happening out there in terms of corporations' reluctance to get involved in this convention.
Who are some of the other holdouts?
Some of the other holdouts, you have a number of Wall Street firms. Well, Apple is one big one. You have a number of Wall Street firms like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America. J.P. Morgan Chase is doing something that a number of people are thinking about doing, which is they gave money to charity. They gave $300,000 to nonprofits in Cleveland and Philadelphia and sort of linked it to the convention, but basically targeted it for youth summer employment.
So some former sponsors then are providing services, but no actual money. Is that effective in helping them keep the lower profile they apparently want?
To some degree. I mean, Microsoft is not giving any money. They're providing tech support. Facebook is providing financial support and other support. Google is going to be the live stream provider. But there are other ways to sort of keep a lower profile. One of them is you can sponsor a delegation. So you're not directly contributing to the convention. You're sort of around the edges of it.
And what does that mean to sponsor a delegation? Does it mean that they're paying actually for the way for the delegates to get there.
Right, right. Yeah. They're contributing to the cost of sending a state delegation. There are parties, there are events that they can have that are not necessarily directly linked to the convention, but are convention related. So there's a lot of sort of tinkering around the edges in terms of trying to have a presence there, but not have a high profile presence just in case.
We should be fair here because there are some companies, UPS and Hewlett-Packard and Ford, that are skipping both Democratic and Republican conventions. Why is that? Why would they choose to bow out on both?
Well, partly because both of them have the potential for protest. Both of them have the potential for controversy. And I think that there's more baggage attached to these candidates this time around, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both. And I think that corporations, they're risk averse. They don't really want to get involved in something that might backfire on them. You see a number of lobbyists who are not contributing. Normally they do. But if their clients aren't there, the lobbyists aren't going there either. And one big group that has not contributed so far far to the GOP convention is major Jewish donors. Republican Jewish Coalition back in 2012 at this point had given $16 million to Mitt Romney. The members of the coalition have given virtually nothing to Donald Trump. So this is a problem for him all around because of his positions. His trade position sours him with Wall Street and with a number of lobbyists. The whole Mexican wall thing doesn't play for a lot of people. His positions are such that people, especially corporations, do not want to be associated with him.
Is something similar happening on the Democratic side?
It's a little harder to figure out what's happening on the Democratic side. It's a little closer to the vest. But I think both conventions are suffering from the fact that in 2014, Congress stopped federal funding for the convention. For 40 years now, they've given $15, $18 million to each convention. That money has dried up. So they're trying to make up for that money. And in many cases, they're really struggling.
So how much is this affecting the two parties then?
The Republicans, for instance, the convention is going to cost them about $64 million. They're about $6 million short now. And I think that some of the money has dried up. Some of the pledges that they had have dried up since Donald Trump became the presumptive nominee. They haven't raised very much money since April. So this is a problem for them and a shortfall that they've got to somehow deal with.
So there was a letter I know from Politico that came out about one way that the Republican committee is asking for money or trying to make up the difference.
Right. They sent a letter to Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. Sheldon Adelson is a
wealthy
casino,
man.
Yeah, billionaire casino magnate. And they asked the couple for $6 million. Now, Sheldon Adelson has said he will support Donald Trump. He ponied up $100 million in 2012 to support Mitt Romney. So I think that that he might be a source, but that shows how sort of the level of desperation that the Republicans have, that they're going out and saying, please give us $6 million so that we can balance the books.
John Carroll, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're keeping a close eye on the events in France today, but we're also going to take a quick look now at some TV news. Networks are gearing up for summer programming and the Emmys. Nominations were announced this week, and HBO dominated again. 94 nominations, the most of any network for the 16th straight year. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
So last year, HBO had 126 nominations. This year, I guess they got downgraded to 94. But what does it mean for the network in September during the ceremony?
Tough times at HBO, right? They have the two shows that got the most Emmy nominations in their category. So the most nominated drama was Game of Thrones. The most nominated comedy was Veep, both on HBO, both part of their Sunday lineup. They're in a good spot right now. I think they're going to be successful come September. The question is a new programming. Is the new programming going to be able to reach the same heights as these other shows, which have a few years on them?
Well, let's talk about that, because there are a lot of people who don't know what to do with themselves on a Sunday night now that Game of Thrones is over. There are a couple of options, though. Vice Principals and Ballers, they're both comedies. Could you tell us about those?
Sure. So these are the shows that are basically stepping up to take the place of Veep and Silicon Valley on Sunday nights on HBO. Ballers debuted last year. It features Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He plays an NFL player who's decided to become a financial consultant. And then Vice Principals is this sort of crass, in-your-face, very profane comedy about these two vice principals who are knuckleheads who want to be principal and unfortunately are passed over for the job. So they decide to try and join forces to unseat the woman who actually got the job.
All right, let's hear a little bit from Ballers. Here's Dwayne Johnson, who plays a former football star, as you mentioned. In this clip, he's going back and forth with Andy Garcia, who's part of the competition. And here, Dwayne Johnson jokes about being confused with another famous actor.
Are you Vin Diesel?
No, I'm bigger and better looking.
Vin, come on, stop playing with him. Yeah, this is Vin Diesel. I'm Bruce Willis.
So, Eric, again, Ballers is considered a comedy, but actually I've seen some of it, and it's a pretty dark take on life after football.
A lot of shows nowadays are riding this fine line between drama and comedy, and Ballers kind of does that. And it's interesting to see Dwayne Johnson kind of step up and really, inhabit that space really well. So he was with Rob Corddry, who you may recognize from The Daily Show and Children's Hospital. And I think because it's about sports and because it airs during the summer, people have kind of slept on this show.
Yeah.
But I thought it was one of the best summer series of last year, and I think it continues in that vein this year.
Well, you've got to think that HBO is considering its next generation of programming, life after Game of Thrones, life after Veep, even though those series aren't over yet. Where do these two shows fit into the future of the network?
So they have a show called The Night Of, and it's a crime drama. It's gotten rave reviews. It was originally developed by James Gandolfini, who used to be in The Sopranos, and now James Turturro has taken over that role after he died. Yeah. And then they have some new shows. They're doing a reboot of the movie Westworld that's been long delayed, that's finally going to come to fruition this fall. They have a woman named Issa Rae, who had a web series called Awkward Black Girl. She's got a comedy called Insecure that's also been delayed a lot, but is finally going to see the light of day. These are some big swings, and they need at least one or two of these shows to work out. This is their incubator, so we'll get a real good look at what their future is going to look like at the end of the year.
Okay, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
The growing list of terror attacks in France is on our minds today. Three in the past 18 months. In January of 2015, the attacks on the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo killed 12 people. 2 days later, hostages taken at a kosher market in Paris, four of them died. Last November, multiple coordinated attacks across Paris on a Friday evening. 130 people were killed in what's become the single deadliest terrorist attack in French history. And now this attack yesterday along the French Riviera in Nice. 84 dead, 10 of them children. More than 200 people are wounded, 50 or more in critical condition. So why France? Here's France's Prime Minister, Maurice Valls.
We are facing a war that terrorism has started against us. The objective of the terrorists is to instill fear and panic. France is a big country, is a big democracy that will not allow itself to be destabilized.
Joining us now is Chris Chivas, Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center and a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. He's also author of The French War on Al-Qaeda in Africa. Chris, welcome.
Thanks.
Now, let's start there. Why so many attacks in France?
Well, there is a question about whether or not there is some kind of a French curse when it comes to these terrorist attacks. Obviously, France has a history of colonialism, has longstanding connections with particular Islamic populations in Africa. But also, importantly, a lot of people for years have pointed to socioeconomic exclusion among Muslim populations in France as a cause of discontent. Now, those factors are undoubtedly important. But France is, of course, not the only country in the world that's been subject to these attacks. We've seen attacks like this also in the United States, which has a very different kind of history and different kinds of opportunities for Muslims living in America. So there's probably some truth to the idea that there is a French curse, but we shouldn't make too much of it.
Yeah, and we are learning a little bit more about the driver of the truck. We know that he is Tunisian-born. He was living locally in France, and he did have a few minor run-ins with the police. In March, he received a six-month suspended prison sentence for violence with a weapon. But as you're following this story, watching it unfold, what else will be important to you to learn about this man as the investigation moves forward?
Well, I think clearly the question of his motivations is very important and something to watch closely. The question of when he came to France from Tunisia is still not clear to me yet. If he came more recently, then that increases the chances that he's part of the broader radicalization problem that we've seen in Tunisia, sending foreign terrorist fighters abroad in higher per capita numbers than any other country in the world. Now, the fact that he was not on any kind of watch lists, that he hadn't been picked up by French counterterrorism officials, and that he doesn't, and from what we know about his personal life, seem to have any kind of signs of radicalization, suggests that probably there were personal grievances involved in this attack, and he may simply have been using the broader fact of terrorist attacks in France and the Islamic State calls for attacks in France as an excuse rather than a motivation for conducting this horrific attack.
So if we come to learn that he'd been living in France for a longer period of time, to you that would indicate more of a lone wolf inspired by a group like ISIS, for instance?
Yeah, or maybe not even inspired. It's also possible that these are just personal grievances, and he's using the fact of recent terrorist attacks in France as an excuse to vent his grievances against the population.
Hmm. Well, anytime something like this happens, we wait for groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda to take responsibility. Now, we have not seen that yet. Does that say anything to you?
I think, you know, it's too soon to say. I mean, we could see something, obviously, you know, very soon, or we might not. I mean, in some way, shape, or form, we can certainly say that the Islamic State and also Al-Qaeda have created conditions in which this kind of attack has become more prevalent, regardless of whether or not he was actually directly inspired by the Islamic State and its propaganda.
Hmm. Well, France has been in a state of emergency since November during the terrible attacks in Paris. So clearly, extra security measures were in place. But I want to listen to one eyewitness. His name is Robert Holloway. He and his wife started walking home after the fireworks in Nice. They were trying to get ahead of the crowd because it was raining at the time. Here's what he told the BBC.
We walked for about 15 minutes, so it was by then about 20 to 11, and suddenly, apparently out of nowhere, we saw this huge white truck coming towards us. It was swaying slightly from side to side and appeared to be hitting the side of the... It was on the walkway, on the promenade, and it was going very fast, and at that point it was clear to us immediately that this was an attack. This man was out to do damage and kill people.
It's terrifying, obviously, to be a witness to that. But as I mentioned, France had extra security measures in place, and it has for a while. Now, we're not exactly clear what kind of security was there at this event. But is there just no way to protect against something like this?
You're never going to have absolute security. The concern about these soft targets has been growing. And obviously, counterterrorism experts are working to try and devise ways to make them less vulnerable. But it's simply an impossible task for law enforcement in any country to provide absolute security of these soft targets against any kind of an attack. And I think it's actually even more difficult if it turns out that this individual, that Bilal, was acting entirely on his own without any connection to other jihadist networks at all within Europe. Obviously, that makes it even more difficult to identify him ahead of time.
Well, and this method was in the playbook of terrorists. Several years ago, the United States put out an advisory on the weaponization of trucks after Inspire magazine released an issue suggesting that its followers of Al-Qaeda and other Islamic groups drive trucks through malls and public spaces to kill people. I mean, what does that say to you, even if this person wasn't technically affiliated with one of these groups?
Well, clearly the use of trucks, either armed or unarmed, we've seen the use of trucks that have been loaded down with explosives as a means of targeting buildings on multiple occasions. That was an Al-Qaeda tactic. We've seen the use of trucks as IEDs, vehicle-borne IEDs, more recently as a tactic used by ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and also, I believe, in Libya. So the use of trucks is certainly something new. The use of trucks that don't carry any kind of explosive with them, yes, as you say, is something that has been encouraged. What can be done to prevent it and to protect these soft targets against it in the future? I simply don't have the answer to that.
We'll be paying more attention to how that might be done, I imagine. I want to listen to French President François Hollande speaking today. Let's hear some of that.
Why Nice? Because Nice is known all over the world, one of the most beautiful cities in the world, of the planet. Why 14th of July? Because it is a celebration of liberty. And to harm France, this is why this individual committed this terrorist attack.
That was French President François Hollande speaking today through an interpreter. But Chris Chivas, I want to ask you, France's position in the global war on terror, its foreign policy, how much of that is playing into these attacks?
I think it's easily over-exaggerated. Some people will argue that France is a target of these attacks simply because it has an aggressive counterterrorism policy in Africa, because it's joined the counter-ISIL coalition with airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. But I think that there may be some truth to that. But the main factors involved in this have much more to do with French history in the region and the disaffection of a significant portion of its Muslim population and the active efforts of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups to try and recruit in France and also build networks in Europe. So there are a lot of different things in play here. French foreign policy is at best one of several factors.
And maybe also French secularism at play here, bans on religious garb in public life, maybe some slow resentment building.
I mean, again, it's impossible to say that the bans on Muslim religious garb in France, the secular culture, have no impact whatsoever. But it would be a mistake to point to that as the sole reason why France has been targeted. It has much more to do with French history, social economic conditions, and frankly, the networks that have grown up in France, as we've seen also in Belgium, that are at the root of this.
Chris Chivas is Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center and a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, following this tragic news out of France today. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Students who enter college for the first time this autumn may notice something right off. There aren't that many men among the freshmen. Traditionally, higher education has been dominated by men. That's been true both here in the U.S. and in the U.K. Well, now male students are a minority. In fact, some British schools have twice as many women students as men. John Marcus has looked at the trend in both the U.S. and in Britain and at efforts to get more men to go to college. He is higher education editor of the Hechinger Report. John, how have the numbers of male versus female students changed over, say, the last 10 years?
It's gotten much more pronounced. And there are several reasons for that. One of them is that there have been a lot of very successful programs to encourage girls to go to college. But also, there's research that shows that about age 11, boys kind of check out of school in many cases. It's not cool anymore to be smart. And in the United States, there's been research that shows that in particular non-white minority boys have what the researchers call economic despair. They don't really see a good reason to go to college. They see very high cost without payback, and they don't see a lot of role models in their lives who have themselves been to college.
But this is kind of a new phenomenon. I mean, this only happened, say, in the past decade or two?
It's become more pronounced. In 1970, men outnumbered women in college in the United States by exactly the same ratio, and the ratio has reversed.
So you say that this is a trend that's happening both in the U.S. and the U.K. When you went to the U.K. to report this story, you really saw it in stark relief when you went to one particular university in one particularly poor part of England.
Right. We went to the University of Liverpool, which is a Russell Group university equivalent to the Ivy League in the United States. Very, very good school. And I was with a photographer, and both of us were just blown away by the immediately evident disparity between men and women. There were just far, far more women. And so when you begin to talk to people about this in either country, the first thing you get is sort of the jokes. Isn't it great to be a man at the University of Liverpool? There's two females for every male. That's the first thing you hear. The second thing you begin to hear is a very thoughtful comment from a lot of women who point out that in both countries, women are still underrepresented in the professions and in Parliament and in Congress. And I don't mean to discount what women are saying about balancing the disparity between the genders in the world. But the other reality is that if boys don't go to college, then we have far fewer people with university degrees to do jobs in the knowledge economy. And in both countries, there are a wave of baby boomer retirements coming. In the UK, which is a much smaller country, they're anticipating 12 million openings for people who need college degrees. And for every year that more women than men go to university in England, there are 36,000 fewer men in college. So as a result, coming out the other end, there are 36,000 fewer potential university degree holders to take jobs in the knowledge economy.
Men or women?
Of any gender.
So a lot of the men you say who are not going on to college are those who feel like it's not even going to be worth it. Two questions on that. One is it worth it if you get a college degree? And secondly, who are these men, both in the UK and the US, who are feeling this way more and more?
A college degree does still pay, no matter how expensive it is.
There and here.
In both countries. Young men 25 to 34 with college degrees in the UK earn 47% more than young men who didn't go to college. But what researchers say in both countries is that in the UK, young white men in poor neighborhoods, only 1 in 10 go to college, only 1 in 10. In the U.S., it's poor black and Hispanic boys, but for largely the same reason. They don't have people around them that went to college. They don't see examples or mentors who went to college, and they don't entirely understand the payoff of the work and expense it takes to go to college.
How seriously are they taking this problem both in the U.K. and the U.S., and what are they doing about it?
In both the U.S. and the U.K., there's acknowledgement of the problem, but much more seriously in the U.K. In the U.S., we have a national program called My Brother's Keeper out of the White House that's meant to encourage young boys and particularly racial minorities to go to college. In the U.K., however, where tuition is regulated, universities are not allowed to charge the maximum tuition unless they put programs in place that are approved by the government to recruit students that are low-income, racial and ethnic minorities, and now boys. And 77 of the about 400 universities in the UK have plans specifically in place to try to increase the proportion of boys.
How?
There are all kinds of different programs. The one that we went to look at was in East London, a very poor neighborhood where 1 in 10 boys go to college. The University of East London sends enrolled college men to work with these kids, to coach them in athletics.
The idea being if you catch them young, get them into sports, then what?
If you catch them young, get them into sports and show them an example of a student who has actually gone to university, in many cases someone just like them.
Who's coaching them now.
Who's coaching them now. They may be encouraged to envision themselves in college, which a lot of these boys don't.
How important do you think this is to the future in both countries?
Well, it's hugely important in both countries. In the United States in particular, we have a goal by 2025 of having 60% of the population with a university degree. We are way, way behind. We're not anywhere near there. Enrollment is declining. So if we can't get every able-bodied potential college student to go through school and get a degree of some sort or a certificate, we're going to fall way behind in the proportion of the population who we need to have degrees to fill the jobs that are essential to a knowledge economy.
John Marcus, thank you.
Thank you.
John Marcus is the higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. We have an update now. Here and Now is going to be following the events in France, as will other NPR programs. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, and we're on our way to Cleveland. Robin will be broadcasting from the Republican National Convention on Monday. It's Here and Now.